a facilitated, sustained experience. It doesn't have to be in a classroom, so it can just be a community of people. Usually the intergroup part means that people come to it from different salient social identities and such that if you were having, I just label myself as temporarily able-bodied, and so if you were having an intergroup dialogue on disability, you'd want people with different relationships to ability, and also facilitators to have that as well. And I love the solution aspect of it in terms of not coming up with solutions, but deliberately working on actions that will help address some of the kind of complex problems that intergroup dialogue tries to focus on, like power and privilege and systems of oppression.
Welcome to Student Affairs Now, the online learning community for student affairs educators. I am your host, Heather Shea. Today on the podcast, I am thrilled to welcome four individuals with a variety of perspectives to join me in a timely conversation about facilitating intergroup dialogue. Before I introduce our panelists today, here is a bit about our podcast and sponsors. Student Affairs Now is the premier podcast and learning community for thousands of us who work in, alongside, or adjacent to the field of higher education and student affairs. We hope you'll find these conversations make a contribution to the field and are restorative to the profession. We release new episodes every week on Wednesdays, and you can find us at studentaffairsnow.com, on YouTube, or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Today's episode is sponsored by Simplicity. A true partner, Simplicity supports all aspects of student life with technology platforms that empower institutions to make data-driven decisions. This episode is also sponsored by LeaderShape. Go to leadershape.org to learn how they can work with you to create a just, caring, and thriving world. As I mentioned, I am your host for today's episode, Heather Shea. My pronouns are she, her, and her, and I am broadcasting from the ancestral, traditional, and contemporary lands of the Anishinaabeg, Three Fires Confederacy of Ojibwe, Odawa, and Potawatomi peoples, otherwise known as East Lansing, Michigan, home of Michigan State University, where I work. So let's get into today's conversation. Jimena, Mark, Bridget, Nina, thank you all so much for joining me today. I'd love to start off with some brief introductions. Tell us a little bit about how you're entering our conversation, your role perhaps on your campus or in higher ed, and a bit about your path to working with campus initiatives around intergroup dialogue. And Jimena, we're going to start with you.
Well, I'm Jimena Suñiga, she, her, ella pronouns. I'm calling from the Naugatuck land of Western Massachusetts. And my role, I'm a faculty member in the Social Justice Education Program at UMass Amherst. And I've been connected to this work for 30 plus years, so I'll just say that. And I'm very excited to be in this room with all these wonderful people.
Well, thank
And
you
I'll
for
pass it
bringing
to
together all of this group. So, yes, thank you so
I'll
much.
pass it to Bridget.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's a joy to be asked to be in a dialogue with all of you. Bridget Turner Kelly, she, her pronouns. I'm an associate professor at the University of Maryland, which is on the stolen lands of the Piscataway people. I have been challenged by, intrigued by, blessed and joyful to be in the dialogue space for over 2 decades, and really looking forward to our conversation about the relevance of it today and our uses of it and what it means and how we operationalize it, because I know it's different from for all of us probably. And I will pass it to Nina.
Hi everyone, I'm Nina Tissi-Gassaway. I use they, them, and she, her pronouns, and I'm a professor of practice at UMass Amherst in our social justice education program and higher education program. And I came to intergroup dialogue about 10 years ago when I was a student in the PhD program at UMass and got to know about intergroup dialogue as a pedagogical practice. And it honestly changed my life. And I have been really intrigued and infatuated with intergroup dialogue ever since then. And I have done my dissertation research on it and now teach our intergroup dialogue practicum course. So that is teaching our graduate students how to be intergroup dialogue facilitators at the same time they are co-facilitating an undergraduate intergroup dialogue course.
Wow, I can't, that sounds amazing. Mark, you're
Yeah, I
last but
know,
not
right?
least. Yeah.
How awesome. My name is Mark Kamimura Jimenez, so using his pronouns. I am on the Osage Nation, Oto, Missouri, and Illini lands. And what's amazing is that like some of the my introduction came really at the University of Michigan. And in my first year there, I actually got to share time with Jimena during visiting or I don't know if you're on sabbatical or learning, coming and learning alongside us, but we were really learning for me too. And I've integrated intergroup dialogue into many of the work, much of the work that I do as an associate vice chancellor for student affairs and in my pathway in student life. And at Michigan, I was actually in one of the first graduate cohorts of participating in an intergroup dialogue. And it was also something that I still remember to this day as a very reflective moment that we don't often get as graduate students. And so most recently, though, we have begun to develop an intergroup dialogue program on our own campus called DXD or Dialogue Across Difference. And so we'll talk a little bit about that as well.
So let's start with some basics because I don't want to assume everybody on the, who's watching today is familiar with intergroup dialogue. Bridget, can you talk a bit about what it is, how it's practiced, and why student affairs educators might want to utilize intergroup dialogue?
Yeah, the three part question, right?
Yeah, right.
So my colleagues can help me if
Yeah.
I don't get all three parts, but a facilitated, sustained experience. It doesn't have to be in a classroom, so it can just be a community of people. Usually the intergroup part means that people come to it from different salient social identities and such that if you were having I just label myself as temporarily able-bodied. And so if you were having an intergroup dialogue on disability, you'd want people with different relationships to ability and also facilitators to have that as well. And I love the solution aspect of it in terms of not coming up with solutions, but deliberately working on actions that will help address some of the kind of complex problems that intergroup dialogue tries to focus on, like power and privilege and systems of oppression. And I think why it's used, how it first started from, as Mark said, from the University of Michigan, and how it got to places where I've done it, University of Vermont, and now at the University of Maryland, where we're happy to just start an intergroup dialogue center in my department. So I'm really excited that expanding. We'll talk about later, I think, how a lot of institutions are looking for ways to have people talk across differences from different social identities, and particularly at a time when we are, as a society, I think, have our options of listening to only people that think like we do or come from the same backgrounds as we do. So how do we get people? And college is as Michigan and all of the awards and different places where it's kind of spread across the country have found that college is a time where people are most likely exposed to people who are from different social identities and come with different backgrounds and experiences. And so college is supposed to be a time of critical thinking and developing ways to talk across differences and ways to be open to other perspectives and examine your own biases and prejudices. And intergroup dialogue is a container that really helps facilitate that. It's one tool that helps us really, I think, we've talked about it in diverse democracy, but I think intergroup dialogue is really a tool that helps us be the kind of institution we're supposed to be, which is open to different ideas and listening to even ideas that we find abhorrent so that we can understand where we're coming from and where the other person is coming from. And so listening for understanding is something that is a skill that can really be utilized with intergroup dialogue. And I think the final thing I'll say about it is that sustained piece. And so it's not something happened on campus and we're going to have a dialogue about it. That's not, it's not a one-time impact. It has, as Jimena will talk about in a little bit, has, discussions and ground rules and structures. As I said, it's a container for how you do a sustained, at least 7 to 12 week experience with folks who come again from different sailing identities, and how you hold that space and invite people into the space consistently every week, as opposed to being something that's exclusive. And so that just start there. Hopefully, I made a dent in the three-part question.
Absolutely. Jimena, what would
Yeah.
you add?
Well, I think I like maybe a couple of things that I think we developed this. We were not thinking in those ways, or perhaps not the way we were in this area of work in higher education. But I think a lot about as a pedagogy of possibility. We're trying to imagine what's possible. We're trying to learn together about what are some of the issues that are up for us and how we can enter. It also requires some advanced preparation. People need to do some reading and writing beforehand. If this is not about throwing people in the middle of, and I think with time also become very in tune with the fact of working with young people. Young people have been socialized in different ways, who in the last 5 years, we are using social media more than anything to communicate, where we all need to develop the muscle of verbal communication. We seldom ask good questions. So I think there's a lot. I think today the practice also has changed a little bit because we're being challenged by the need to humanize microspaces, to bring people in, and to engage with difficult conversations. So I think I have rethought a little bit what we do in a little bit of a different way. And we're trying to blend, from Buber, I doubt, to Freire and bell hooks, critical consciousness, to think about systems and then moving to resistance, but also noting that and this is something I think we have learned in the last 10 years is that for a long time we thought in binaries, oppression, liberation. Now we're trying to coordinate the two because we know that oppression always sits along resistance. People have been resisting oppression for centuries. So how we can uplift that too, not just focus on on one or the other. So I do think that that's not easy. But that's the aspiration. So I think I'll just to add that and underscore what Bridget said about sustain. Yeah, these are sustained processes. They're facilitated. They require some advanced preparation. People need to read, write, and think, ideally before they come to the classroom or the room, the space that they join in. And also it's intersectional. It's not just about a binary conversation. I think it's how do we bring multiple issues to the table and coordinate those and help people work along that. So I think that's the way I think about it today. That's that, it was hard to frame it in those ways 20 years ago, but I think today, I think our thinking has been moved by so many movements and by the work of bell hooks and Edgar Mary Brown and so many people who are helping us think in a more micro way of,
Perfect. What
So,
else, Mark? Nina, what would you add? Anything to
I think that it is a challenge to get our, when we think about intergroup dialogue, the focus on understanding, I just to underline that as a No, times three. That I think is essentially one of the biggest things that our students can gain from engaging in intergroup dialogue, because it can serve them in so many different spaces. But how we get to that space and how we build to that moment becomes the challenge. And I think it's also the path, the journey of college, right? I think, when Bridget was talking about, the reflective complexities of the college experience and all the that's happening to you and around you in this space, I think it's really telling that this is a journey of students, opportunity to understand not just I think by understanding the other people, they get to understand themselves in so much deeper ways.
Yeah, and I would just echo, along with what Bridget and Jimena said about, how it's it's a muscle, right? And it takes preparation, and it's counter to so many norms, the way that our society functions now. Dialogue asks us to step out of our bubble, right? It asks us to engage and ask questions and not make assumptions when those are the systems that our world operates on now more than ever. And so it really is counter-normative, and I think that that's what makes it so powerful and also so challenging sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
So,
absolutely.
and a
Maybe.
lot piece about the journey piece that I
Yeah.
think Mark is, we don't value journeys in hierarchy, okay? So journeys, it's not something that we value. So we talk about it, but we don't hold journey, maybe. So I do think that there's something there, and journeys are, they're not unclear, and I think the outcomes are not always easy to codify. So I think that's the other piece that I think we have struggled. We know from research that this works, but I think there's much more what happens for people in these experiences. And I work with faculty who do this work, and staff, and undergrads and grad students. But it takes time, so we don't know at the end of a course what happens for people. So it takes more than that. So I think that. That's also what's challenging. It's a journey here, and we don't know even how to codify the outcomes of the journey. But, and that's hard in higher ed because you're supposed to have evidence and clear
Right.
markers so
Right.
we can brand
And
things.
by the time that they graduate, right? Like we need to know that it had some kind of measurable effect. And yeah, sometimes 5 or 10 years later, that's a whole nother episode, right?
Yes,
Reflective
yes,
practice and how do we document student learning.
yes.
But I am really curious. So Jimena, you talked, been doing this work for 30 years. And your approach kind of maybe originally was a four-part approach. I'd love to hear how that evolved. And I believe you have a visual aid that we're going to share with folks in our show notes.
Yes, well, I'll say that in a minute, but yes, I'm going to show you a slide. But yes, to put in simple terms, in lay terms, yeah, when we started to do this work, many of us came from group work, women's studies, ethnic studies, social psychology. So trying to coordinate, and we knew that this had to be different than what we did in group work in social work, group work in social psychology, group work in women's studies. We knew this had to be different, but and we had some intuitions about what. So in that way, we start thinking about how do we do this? How do we bring people together to have these conversations? And how do we scaffold the process? So I think that's where the four stages came through, is how do we scaffold this journey? How do we organize it? How do we bring people in? So, and with time we have, it has changed. For example, I know it changed. At the beginning of the work, for a long time, we put action at the end. We started this thinking, this is a bit silly to assume that action is going to happen at the end. I think we have to teach people how to think about action. So some of us start developing these intergroup collaboration projects, let's say 20 years ago, by stage two. So people start thinking about action planning and action taking early on, because often students don't even know how to do this. They have not been exposed to plan action for social change. So I think so the model has these four stages, but the truth is that some of us that, have tweaked the model in order to expose participants to action planning early on and to motivate and maybe support people that we can all interrupt and create new possibilities. So how do we go? It's not at the end only. Also, the notion of alliance building has been a bit troubled by many people. What's an ally? And I don't want to get caught in the language, but
That's
clearly,
a whole nother episode too, right?
yes.
Yeah.
But I think coming from a coalitional logic, we're trying to bring people together to think about actions, knowing that they may need support from people like them, different from them. Whether it's an alliance, allyship, coalition, that's fine. That we can theorize about that. But indeed, the point is, you cannot do this work alone. So considering those points, I'm going to screen share this. What I would say it's a way of thinking. So today, the way I think about this is, let me see how, all right. Can you see it?
Yes.
Can you see? Okay. And I'm going to say four stages of intergroup dialogue. We often think about intergroup as an intergroup dialogue, but I've done a lot of intragroup among women, intragroup among people of color, intragroup among white people. Okay, so these are These are not always intergroup, they're
Oh.
intragroup. Yet, any conversation is intergroup conversation. A BIPOC conversation is an intergroup conversation. And all women conversation is also an intergroup conversation. It's about sexuality, it's about race, about class, first generation. So in a way, this intergroup dialogue is a bit of a myth, because the truth is all conversations have an intergroup nature, whether they're intragroup or intergroup. I think the key thing here is that when we invite this conversation, we try to have people from different groups in the conversation. So we move away from the only one. So we don't want to have one person for one identity. We try to make sure that we have a balanced composition so people don't feel alone or don't feel like the only one. So four stages, the way we think about it today, or I think about it today, is, you know, group beginnings. I think we all do that, building a learning community, doing guidelines, how are you, clarifying goals, getting to know each other, hopes and concerns, clarifying distinction between dialogue and debate and discussion. These are three different ways of communication that are different. And I think it's important to clarify what do we mean by that. And indeed, practicing some basic skills like active listening and voicing. There are other skills. And then exploring commonalities and differences. And I think we all probably do this a little bit differently, but the idea is that how we invite students, participants, faculty, and staff to think about their personal identities, social identities, and multiple identities, and how those may impact the conversation that they're going to be having during this journey. And we do, of course, affinity group conversation, mixed group conversation. And also we expose people to think about this systemically. So they can look at this system in place that's really impacting all of us. In a way, we're all be victims of the system, whether we have privilege or disadvantage. We're all being put in this role. And as young people, that is even more prevalent. So this is something I learned a lot from Barbara Love. You know, centering the youth experience, seeing that these students and people as people who were put in this system. And the goal here is how we learn to navigate the system in a more liberatory way. And then indeed, we explore current and controversial issues. You know, some of us do three, four of the sessions. We talk about migration issues. We talk about reproductive rights. We talk about climate change, maybe. We talk about race on campus, microaggressions, microaffirmation. That's something that we have learned also lately, is that we cannot just talk about microaggressions. We also think about microaffirmation. We cannot just talk about the ugly. We also think about, okay, how do you counter this? And I think for a long time, we're so focused on teaching about oppression that we didn't balance the conversation with other elements. So I think for me, that's really important. How do we balance it? And from there, of course, at the end is where do we go from here and how we celebrate our learning? So I think that's the piece that, and I think at UMass, we tend to do more of that in stage four, because in stage two, people start thinking about these action projects. And we place people in trials or quartets to develop a project over 4 weeks or 5 weeks. So they start thinking a lot about action taking. And people do all kinds of things. Not big projects, but people learn to plan an action project. So that's the way we scaffold these. Indeed, the number of weeks and meeting time that you have will indeed impact how you do this. But the idea is you have to build capable together, build community, develop some common language, explore some basics around who we are as people, as individuals, as members of groups, and then to explore some issues. And that's important. Why? Because people practice what they're learning in those conversations. And it's a muscle, like Nina said, so you have to find ways to support developing the muscle.
Wonderful.
So
I love this.
Feel free
I
to
love this diagram.
To,
yeah. This
I
is
don't
super
know if,
helpful. We will
I don't know if people want to add anything to this, but that's the basic.
Maybe I'll have you stop screen sharing and we'll make sure we
sure.
include this in our show notes. For today, it's such a great diagram.
Let me add one thing. For a long time, we were, you know, we sent we config was, and some of us do this I don't think I do that too much at UMass. Stage three was a lot about exploring conflicts. That was very much the Michigan model. I have moved away from that. Why? Because well, the logic of the SGA program will be different. The way we're not centering conflict exploration in our program content. So I cannot, you know, we're still dealing with conflict, but that's not the focal point. Whereas in Michigan, for example, and other places, that's the lingo they use to explain what they do and how they do it. So I want to say that I think different programs in different places of the country may reframe how they set up stage two and three, depending on who they're working with, what's their context. And also, now because of the pandemic, I think we also have tried to use more kind words to frame the task, because people are scared to talk. So current issues seem more easy to digest than controversial issues or conflict issues. So I think language matters, and I think we need to think about how we frame these stages in context.
Yeah, thank you. We've been having this conversation. We have a weekly call, all of the folks who host episodes on the podcast, and we've been thinking about a variety of topics. And this one, I think, really, you know, is part of a larger series. You know, we thought about cultivating brave spaces. We're talking about bridging divides between Jews and Muslims. And Nina, I'm really struck about, you know, how maybe we might think about intergroup dialogue as a tool. You know, I think it's one of the, as we talked earlier about, one of the many tools potentially in the toolbox, but given the current kind of climate of, you know, political unrest, polarization, attacks on DEI work, you know, what are some of the ways that campus administrators might identify this as one of the tools that they could use?
Yeah. You know, I think that it is definitely a tool that can be used to help respond to so many different social political moments. And this is certainly one of them. And I think that, you know, like many other folks on the call, when events like the ones that are happening right now in the Middle East or, you know, elsewhere around our world take place, I think there's a sense of urgency to respond. Mm-hmm. And that's rightfully so, right? Like, I know there's so much pressure that exists on upper level administrators, and students want an answer right now. They want to see things. You know, we talked about seeing visible results, right? And not being able to, you know, necessarily see those right away. And so while I understand that, I know that intergroup dialogue may not be the thing that helps them do that, respond in the urgent way in which they want to, because like we've all said, right, dialogue is a muscle that we need to build, right? And so we need to think about how are we responding proactively in ways that might not help address this urgent crisis right now, right? But ones that will help us prepare for crises that undoubtedly will come in the future. So how are we working to expand our campus's capacity for dialogue? How do we help build those muscles, right? And increase the amount of people on campus who have the muscles in order to do these dialogue, or even to be in meaningful conversations with people who might think or are different than we are. And I don't think right now that there are many people who have that capacity or willingness to do it, right? And so I think dialogue is powerful in that way, because it shows us how we can come together across difference. But I do think that there's intentionality around intergroup dialogue being a sustained and not a one-time thing, right? Like as folks were saying earlier, dialogue also takes a willingness to engage, right? And so when some folks are in conflict, they aren't willing to sit in a room and talk with each other. And that might be fear, like Jimena was saying, that people are scared to talk, or it could just be that they're angry, right? And maybe they don't have the capacity right now to sit in a room. And if folks aren't willing to talk, you can't make them dialogue. And so I think all of those things make it hard for IGD to be a responsive tool, like an instant tool in that way. But I do believe that there's power in what dialogic responses can do, but we have to focus on equipping people with the knowledge, skills, and tools that are needed in order to do it effectively and in order to do it in ways that are meaningful and really do bring about the change that we want and expect.
Nina, if I could just jump in and because I know we want to have more of a dialogue and not just have Heather just
Question,
interview
answer,
us.
question, answer.
So I just wanted to get your perspective on what you were just talking about in terms of maybe dialogue being used, I use that word, as Amanda said, words matter, being used as a tool to cool things on campuses. Because just to do some active listening with you, you know, you were just talking about it's not going to be that quick response. If you're angry, it's not good. If you can't, if people aren't willing to talk, it's not good. And so asking those of us who facilitate dialogues to do so immediately in a crisis, I don't know if you've had experience with that or can talk about that, how it could be used to kind of just temper things down as opposed to be the proactive tool that I think we all would love it to be.
I'm sure that you all could speak to other moments as well, but I think it is tempting, right? It is tempting to have dialogue be used in that way, right? And it is tempting to be able to try and use our skills in those moments to be responsive. But I think the more that I do this work, I know that that is not the way that we should be using these skills in these spaces, and being willing to say no, right? Like, this isn't the tool right now, but what else is possible? Or how are we working to build capacity for the next time?
When you're talking, we've been talking about using it as a muscle. I love that because it's true, right? It's something that you have to. You can't just go out and run a long distance or even a short distance, actually. And as a former sprinter, I I am quickly reminded when I'm trying to chase my dog, and but. I think the big thing to re like for me when I think about that is also that even our most elite athletes and those most skilled facilitators can still get injured, pull a muscle, right? Because what the preparation that it takes to engage in these spaces is requires the stages, right? It requires us to build into the work. And so, like when I don't know where, the order here, but just it makes me think about the work that we are starting to do with our facilitators on campus, and that is really putting them in dialogue as well, so that they're able to be prepared to think through their own self-reflective moments and the listening to their own bodies, right? Thinking about how they're responding to things that are said in dialogue, but also being prepared to then, pivot or understand the context in which things are being and how week to week at times that is changing. And so, anyway, I just kind of, when you mentioned that, it made me think of those pieces.
Other thoughts?
So I'll say one word here. Also, something I learned from my mentor. So this I learned from my mentors in Michigan. And when we started to do this work, with a lot of conflict going around. And as Nina was saying, I was very tempted to move into a reactive mode. But I think maybe something I learned was, Jimena, let's focus on being proactive. I think our charge is to be proactive, to build capacity. Yes, you can respond. And there are times where I responded. I supported difficult conversations. But yet, when I did that, I put some conditions. Okay, yes, we will enter, but it needs to be 4 weeks. We need to have four sessions. We need to have this type of facilitator. We need to do something on the assessment. So we cannot just jump in. So I think we could do that. But I do think that the part that I think, yeah, that we have to be able to teach systems that this is a proactive methodology. It's not something that you can just, it's not a quick fix. Mm-hmm. And a quick fix will likely backfire, and people need to be willing to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I think that's, because sometimes people say, let's require all students to do interview dialogue. I've heard that. I said, no, let's not do that, please.
I wonder, you know, if, like, I agree that, right, that intergroup dialogue shouldn't be responsive, and it is tempting to be pulled in. But I wonder if there are ways that, mm-hmm. if even if it's not intergroup dialogue, I wonder if there's like dialogic skills or
yes.
tools
yes.
that
yes.
we
yes.
can use, right, to yes. have in those moments as our responses. Mm-hmm. And that's often what I think about, right? Like if I am in a conversation with someone who has a different perspective or might be a little bit more heated about something, like, is there something that I can use in that moment that is dialogic, right? But it's not doing an intergroup dialogue or.
Sure.
Or,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a great point. Bridget, I know we talked a little bit in the beginning or before we got on the call about how you've used this specifically in student affairs graduate preparation programs. And I'm really curious about that. And also, you know, again, this kind of goes back to the equipping facilitators with skills.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. are they doing similar work to what Nina's group is doing too?
Yeah, I think so. And even what Mark shared in the intro about what they're doing. Student affairs seem like a natural fit with intergroup dialogue when I first started teaching student development theory or intro to student affairs and care for the whole student and understanding. And you know, you've got some real life practitioners, educators on the call, so I'm not going to pretend I'm one. I've always just been a faculty member, but as I understand the work and think about I think about them as kind of first responders to our college students. And how can you be in authentic relationship with these college students and be kind of journeying along with them, which is my understanding of student affairs, if you don't understand them, if you don't understand their perspectives, if you can't find a way to have them be authentic and get a trusting kind of vulnerable relationship with you. And so as I was teaching graduate students who wanted to be student affairs educators, intergroup dialogue within the classroom seemed like a way to help them reach that goal, but also to help them work through some of the things that maybe they didn't get to work through when they were college students or, and that they can't really work through on the job, because then it might be harming the very students and people and parents and other people that they work with. And so how do we have those real live conversations and dialogues where they get to be vulnerable and they get to examine their biases and their prejudices and, as Mark said, understand others and then understand themselves a little better. And so I started setting up our class and intergroup dialogue where we did the stages. I'm a believer of Ximena and Zuniga and other folks' model. And so we started by how do we form that beginning process in the group and build trust, and how do we think and kind of teaching them about what facilitation looks like and some of those dialogic skills that Nina's talking about, and working with a co-facilitator, because intergroup dialogue typically has people who are working together with a group and facilitating. And then I would facilitate the first few weeks with small parts of the class, depending on how many students I had, maybe about 10 to 12 students in kind of like a fishbowl situation, and have the other 10 to 12 students on the outside looking at our process and our content, and then a debriefing as a large class. And then about 4 weeks into the class, after they'd kind of formed some of those communities and done some of that early work that Ximena talked about in the first stage of the model, then I would turn the second half of class over to them, and they would facilitate intergroup dialogues with each other and small groups, and then we process. And then at my best, when I was doing this as a PhD student, when I was at Maryland, I then had those students work with undergraduate students. I think kind of like what Mark's model is, and facilitating intergroup dialogues with those students. And now I'm back at Maryland as a faculty member, and our students are allowed to do kind of a practicum after they've gone through this course with one of us as faculty. I've been teaching it most recently. Then they're able to sign up to be a co-facilitator with some other folks, with undergraduate students who are taking the course. And so it's that learning and being that vulnerable and being in it yourself before you have to then work with undergraduate students. And I think it's taking off at our institution. Like I said, we just are starting a center because we need to, as Nina said, build up the capacity of more and more people. So not just our graduate students, but graduate students and students all across the university need these skills and are going to need to be peer facilitators and different things for people who are trying to get that capacity, not for any current specific problem in society, but as Nina said, or Ramona said, there's always something going on in society. So how can we build up that capacity for people so that we can already be in conversation and in dialogue before something happens and that we have those relationships established? And the last thing I'll say is I think the research has shown, because I've researched this and other folks have, that those facilitators who've done that, participated in this intergroup dialogue as graduate students, when they go into their practice as an educator, have some of those dialogic skills and are able to have just another tool in their toolbox in addition to counseling and other helping skills that people learn in student affairs. That's really enabled them, I think, to build trust and community and be, as I said, an authentic relationship with the students that they're working with. So, not necessarily they are doing dialogue facilitation, like I am in a formal sense as a faculty member, but they're able to use it in their practice. And we've seen it in social work and we've seen it in counseling and other programs too. And so it is a not the holy grail. It's not a the tool, but it is a tool that I think helps people.
So
And I
you
don't know if
said
Mark
not.
or Nina, if that's similar to how you've set up programs at UMass and other places where you've worked.
Mark, I'd love to hear more
Mark?
about you. Yeah, your work specific. I mean, we talked about not being about a specific topic, but certainly we're at kind of a moment where our campuses are looking for tools to discuss conflict in the Middle East. And in our preparation, we were thinking a little bit about that in particular. So, Mark, tell us some more
Sure.
about what you've done at
Yeah.
WashU.
I totally agree. It's not like this is not the tool to fix everything, but I think that it provides us an opportunity for engaging communities and engaging our campuses in some structured ways. And so, but we also have to be thoughtful about the context in which we do it. So, when October 7th happened, I think there was this immediate like urge to do something. But in our case, I think the right thing to do was to hold and let the community digest what was happening, how people were feeling, and understand where our students were at in that moment. And so as just in our own reflection of developing dialogues for students, because we knew that this was something we wanted to consider, and we would go back and forth with what this could look like. And I'll share, but it's not like I don't think it was like anything ultra complex. I think the timing, though, did matter. We did create some space, and actually, Jimena talks about the inter and intra, and so we actually embraced that. We embraced the fact that students are pro-Israel or had a Jewish identity, and they may not. That those things don't like mean the same thing, right? But we wanted to make sure that students who had a position could have a space in which they shared that space with others. Then we had students who either were connected to or had a pro-Palestinian position and brought those students together. We had then students who wanted to have dialogue. The intergroup dialogue. They wanted to have a dialogue with folks who had different perspectives, and then the fourth one was students who didn't have necessarily any affiliation or even a position that they wanted to take, and wanted to learn or understand more about how others were processing as well. And so those four groups, we had to then go and find the right facilitators. I shouldn't say the right, but facilitators who had some experience, and also I would say were willing to have some courage to facilitate in a space that is highly contentious, right? And I think that there was a lot of fear in different spaces for many different reasons of why people didn't want to talk about it. But I think talking about how people were feeling and how they were experiencing things and understanding their personal connections to a space or to people and to identity and things that were impacting who they were, I think really had an extraordinary impact on broadening understanding. And it didn't stop protests. It didn't stop people, from having their positions, but it did have, I think, an impact on those students and these. And I'd like to hear a little bit more from Jimena about this, but like these micro learning spaces, these micro dialogic spaces that really had positive impact.
Well, I'd say thank you for sharing that and for describing it so well, Mark. Yeah, I think that's a nice way of working through the complexity of these landscapes. I think for me, okay, so on the one hand, we're trying to invite people to have a conversation and to find a space to process whatever they need to process and to explore the questions they want to explore. But then we're also trying to model that's possible. I think for me, this is a tension that we're trying to both model that this is possible. People can sit and have a difficult conversation. Like those students who decided to have an intergroup conversation, I'm sure they went and told their friends. Yeah, I, we were, you know, we're, you know, we had students here, you know, doing this conversation. That to me, that there's a power in that, and I think indeed we have to dare to invite that conversation, but indeed that's a power. So it's not only what happens, you know, for them, but also that brings hope, and hope also is a muscle that we have to develop. So I think for me, yeah, I think it's beautiful what you did there, and that you had a methodology to how to invite different people with different questions to different tables. And yeah, and I think maybe that's the challenge for us, is that one size when I don't doesn't fit everyone. So we have to be very creative about how we do it. And we don't have full control, and we are very scared of that. Faculty would love to have control. We want to be control conversation, control the space. And when you open it up, you don't have control. So next week we're doing this thing that I'm not sure how it's going to evolve, but we're going to try it and see if we can organize a good conversation around these guests that are coming from the Middle East. So I think that's all what I want to say. I'm curious if Bridget or Nina, you have anything else to add about this, but I think this is powerful.
Yeah, I just wanted to know some more clarifying questions, another dialogic skill. How long were these dialogues, Mark? And was it is it volunteer that people could be in, and facilitators, were they compensated? Were they employees? Were they students? So just questions, clarifying questions.
Yeah, and that we had, I think it was the like 4 or 5 days after we were
Oh,
already
wow.
like thinking about, okay, what would this look like? And that was a little bit of the, all right, let's take a time out. Let's start gathering information about also, what's the willingness of, if we have no facilitators, then, that's not going to work either. But those were all professional staff on our campus. And they had also had some previous experience, but also, were trained in our program here. What was interesting is as we're developing the curriculum or the present, how we were going to structure that time, one of the folks had said, "Oh, I think we can do this in like an hour and 15 minutes or something like that." I was like, "No." And so we started bargaining for time. I'm like, "No, we got it. Like, I want, we started 3 hours. I think we settled on 2.5 hours or something like that." But it also depended on the time of day and, because students need to eat, and faculty and staff have other things, but like there was a commitment to the time and a commitment to the space. And after like talking it through, understanding that this was not a course section, this is different. And that I think sometimes it's we take an educator lens versus a dialogue lens. And so that build of time in that space might mean that person that started just listening and absorbing needs the full at 90 minutes to like say one thing, right? And how powerful may that moment have been for that person, or even what they say, right? So I think that there was also a dialogue. The development of the dialogue is a dialogue, right? Sharing why, from my position, this is important, or experience, and we all have had different lived experiences around dialogue, and so bringing all those together was important.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the barriers potentially to implementing intergroup dialogue initiatives and how they might be overcome. It sounds like, skilled facilitators is a really important commitment, right? That a program is going to make if they're going to hold space, for difficult conversations. And time, right? Time and all of that requires resources. So, Mark, can you talk a little bit about, I think you're building a new program. How did you go about doing it? What kind of barriers have you faced? And then how have you overcome those?
So, I think one of the big things that has nothing to do with dialogue is creating credit, for a class. Working with our academic partners to understand and see that this is, there's a model, this is a, there's a lot of research and literature around dialogue, and explaining that, I think, and presenting that to committees that approve courses who may not share the same kinds of academic preparation that we do around this work is important. And so, and also understanding the campus, right? So every campus may be a little bit different. We're working right now on a in a one credit class, and that has been a little bit of a challenge because it's a short period of time. And so we have these very short classes, or 80 minutes, and then you have to move them along in a very short period of time. I've thought about, okay, should we do it every other week? So there's more experience of the semester, right? There's all these different aspects of challenge that are kind of logistic, but I do think that also having folks committed to showing up, like students showing up to class and fully engaging. I think that sometimes there's a topic that may be more, there might be resistance to it. And I think I'm often reminded, like I think it was mentioned earlier about oppression and resistance. But and sometimes there's a the resistance, or even the silence, is a reflection of the our students' own awareness of their identity. And that in and of itself can also become a moment of progression. And so getting our, like working with our facilitators, they're trained in many different fields. So they're not higher ed folks only. And so talking about student development, talking about the path of a student experience, that we have undergraduates who may be first years and fourth years, right? Because every year is included, or they can take the class. And so those present some challenges, but it's important for our facilitators to be aware of where students may be in their undergraduate experience. So we do, at the end of every week, we bring all of our facilitators along, and we talk through what worked, what didn't work, what things are people working with in other classes, and how are we building upon that, and sometimes they'll switch, they'll move, they'll borrow from each other. And I think that has been a very positive outcome. And this next year, we're also going to pitch a 3-credit class. I think that the students are, they've been asking for that. They were like, we want more time. This fall, we're also going to have all of our first year students engage in a 3-hour dialogue to start their bear, we call it bear beginnings, slippery, washi bears. And that will be a part of their onboarding experience at WashU. And we're excited about what happens there. And then we're going to create, like Himeno was talking about, these micro groups. So these are small group dialogues with their undergraduate facilitated groups.
I love it. It sounds like
can I ask a question to Mark?
For sure.
So Mark, sounds like you're the champion. So talk to me about being a champion. I've been a champion in my old days, but not fully a champion right now. Trying to be a champion. So teach me a little bit how can you be a champion? What are the arguments that a champion should to bring to the conversation? I'm curious about Bridget too, you're sending to the center. I'm curious, how are you making the case for this work, but also for process? Because I think we all understand that process is important, that time, that how we engage matters as much as what we talk about. The how matters as much as the what. But that's really hard to convey in higher ed. So I'm curious how the two of you are inviting people to think with you on this. Are you persuading? What kind of resources you have? I'm trying to persuade some people you met, so I'm trying to
build our
I'm curious about how you're moving the needle in your campus.
Well, I can, I'll try to be quick here, but I think we were a little, we have an advantage of Andrew Martin being our chancellor, who is the dean of LSNA at the University of Michigan, and had a front seat to seeing the impact the intergroup dialogue has. And so when it, but it wasn't something that he led with. It's something that he also, I think, saw the opportunity as our campus is developing under his leadership, and also hiring my vice chancellor, who was doing intergroup dialogue at the University of Illinois in the past, and Lewis and Clark and Dr. Ana Gonzalez. And so I think that there's been a unique collection and development of leadership on our campus. We have done some workshops with our board of trustees. And what I love is the fact that they don't want to stop talking about the topics, and it has some vibrant conversations there. And I think that it's experiencing the value that it can have for our students, I think is clear when you experience it. And that has been a positive facilitator, if you will, of dialogue. So,
thank you. That's helpful.
Yeah, I would say at Maryland, as probably no surprise, it's a research one institution. So evidence matters, and data matters. And thanks to people like Jimena and colleagues at Michigan and across the country who have been doing this tireless research on intergroup dialogue and showing the dialogic skill, the application, the why, the critical thinking, the perspective taking that students are able to get, the critical consciousness that they're able to develop from participating in intergroup dialogues is very compelling. But I think what really pushed it over the edge in terms of intergroup dialogue being a part of the diversity requirement, which is why we're trying to build up capacity at the University of Maryland, is the students. The students made some demands around a lot of the racial reckoning and different, not just the US or global racial reckoning, but specific things that happened on the University of Maryland campus. And really asked for those things and kind of held the administration feet to the fire in terms of accountability. And we've been asking for these things and, where are them and where are they? And so, and a lot of hard work from people who've been kind of in the trenches doing the dialogue work on campus and different honors programs and different places around the campus. And we as a group merged together and worked on proposals and things. And so I think it was kind of a trifecta of the students asking for it, the evidence was there, people who were willing to put the labor in and talk about the usefulness and utility of intergroup dialogue. That's really brought it up to capacity. And we're all at the University of Maryland, it's all about do good, it's a public good. And how can we kind of create this civic discourse and engagement and talk civilly across differences? We're a state with just had a Republican governor and, and Mark Hogan, and now have a Democratic governor, but there's that tension, right? There's not a homogeneous sense of how the system should move forward on these cases. So I think it really took a lot of hard work and labor by people, but also the students really pushing that, just as like how we got ethnic studies, right? And women's studies and LGBT studies and centers. We're finally getting centers for those things on campus too, because students have been asking for them. And so it's wonderful that to see the power of the student voice and to see that they, even as young people, have a vision for what they'd like to see. And as Nina said, kind of a resistance to some of the social media and the ways that people are being socialized and encouraged not to talk across differences. And the students are, I think, thankfully saying that's not why we came to college. We came to engage in these issues and topics. And so that's been, it's been wonderful to watch.
I love this conversation. I think what I'm going to do is move us to final thoughts, but I think that we should have a part two. Because there's many questions that we didn't unpack. So folks who are listening today, you might be like, but how does this intersect with broader conversations? What about power and privilege, and where does that fit? So stay tuned. We will get this group back together, or an iteration of it, to talk about those questions as well. So our final thought, we always kind of end with the same thing. This is, podcast is called Student Affairs Now. So we'd love to hear what you are thinking about, troubling, excited about, questioning now. And then if you would like to share how people can connect with you, that would be great. So Bridget, I'm going to start with you.
Great. I think having more conversations like this, having more dialogues like this, we tend to stay in our silos, as a faculty member, and then being able to be with Mark and other people who, and a professor of practice with Nina, and so other people who come at the work differently. And so that's what I'm thinking about now, is how do I involve myself and invite myself into dialogues and conversations with people who are not just thinking about publishing research and writing books and things, but how do I engage? And as I get further in my career, how do I have an impact kind of beyond the writing that I do or the research that I do? And then you can get in touch with me on LinkedIn. I'm active on that platform. Also, really easy to find me for email for btkellywan@umd.edu. I'm still a person that reads all my emails and can't say I'll get back to you right away, but definitely that's a way to engage with me as well. So thanks, Heather.
Yeah, thanks, Bridget. Mark, what about you? Your final thoughts?
So many. But I think, I don't know why, but it just like it's making me think like stretch is like, work like don't get overconfident in the things that work, because we need to be thinking about how to we're not we'll likely not be prepared for the next thing. So if we're, if I think about it metaphorically, if I'm stretching, if I'm working with my team on a regular basis to talk through even issues that are positive, like what's the positive opportunity here in terms of like not embracing necessarily the conflict, but thinking about a positive conversation and how dialogue can and revolve that, I think is really what's kind of like the popping in my mind right now. And so more to come.
Thanks, Mark. Nina.
I'm still deeply resonating and ruminating on something that Bridget said at the start of our conversation, actually. Thinking about, you said, I heard you say, IGD helps us to be the type of institution we ought to be, or what we're supposed to be. And I totally deeply resonate with that. Like when I think about equity, when I think about sense of belonging, when I think about like meaningful engagement or instilling hope in a next generation or equipping our students with tools to be in relationship with or transform the world. Like, we know all those things happen through intergroup dialogue, right? We have the evidence, we have the research, as you were saying. And so I'm just thinking about, like, going back to this idea of championing this work, like using those things that we know to be true, right? And making them in alignment with the goals that are already clear to our institutions, right? And the evidence that we already have, and just bringing those in conversation with each other to really champion this work.
Thanks, Nina. Jimena, thank you so much for bringing together this incredible group. What are your final thoughts?
I think for me, I think listening to Bridget and to Mark and Nina and I have been, thinking together how we can move the needle. Nina and you, Matt. So we have had our own conversation. It's helpful to hear you, Mark and Bridget. Well, then, it's true. We do have some answers, but there's competing priorities. So it's hard to move the needle when there's so many competing priorities. So for me, the question is, how do we link what you just said, Nina? That was beautifully said. But it's also about how do we influence systems? And I think I was glad to hear Mark you talking, the provost of, the dean that you meet and came to be the provost. That's helpful. We have a chancellor now who was at UIC and he was exposed to intergroup dialogue there. So indeed that helps. But then how do you align, because we have been doing this work for 25 years here, or almost, 25 years. And yet it's been hard to center it. It's been hard to, we offer courses. We have trained 200 grad students to do this work. 60% of those work in student affairs in the country. So we have contributed to the work, yet we haven't been able to center or have a center. We haven't been in that position for whatever different reasons. So it's, I think for me, that's the question. How do we learn? On the one hand, we know that this is a powerful pathway. But yet, what are some of all the factors that help us move the needle? And indeed, some of this is political, some of this is evidence, some of this is having champions like Mark, like Bridget, like Nina, like I. But it takes more than champions. And I think we need to be transparent about that. More than evidence, more than champions. It calls for more. Because this work is held by champions in many places in the country. With one, two, three, four, many staff members. But it's champions who lead the way because it's very hard to explain to someone who hasn't been exposed to its value. And I like what you, Mark, you said. Having the trustees having the conversation, they engage it. 2 years ago, my former provost brought two trainers from Michigan to do a training for faculty in the sciences. They were blown away by the whole thing. So that opened the door for some of us to move the needle a little bit farther because they experienced the power of conversation in a time where, we're mostly talking through Zoom. So I think there's also that element. But I do think that maybe that's something that I've missed in the process, is to inviting the leaders to have conversations. And maybe that's something to think about. And that's another, maybe another way to move the needle is to invite, the provost and people to have different conversations and do them in a way that are engaging. So they value the power of this process. I'm rambling, but it's great. Thank you, Heather, for bringing us
Of
together.
course.
Indeed, this is an important work, and and thank you for all of you for spending time together.
Yeah, I am so grateful for all of you sharing space and bringing your wisdom to this topic and your experiences on your campuses. So thank you for joining me on this episode. I also want to take just a moment to express my gratitude to our incredible producer, Nat Ambrosi. Nat, your efforts don't go unnoticed, and we thank you so much for making us look and sound great. And also, thanks to today's episode sponsors, Leadershape partners with colleges and universities to create transformational leadership experiences for students and professionals with a focus on creating a more just, caring, and thriving world. Leadershape offers engaging learning experiences on courageous dialogue, integrity, equity, resilience, and community building. And you can find out more by visiting leadershape.org or connect with them on Facebook, Twitter, X, I guess it's actually called Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our other sponsor today is Simplicity. Simplicity is the global leader in student services technology platforms with state-of-the-art technology that empowers institutions to make data-driven decisions specific to their goals. A true partner to the institution, Simplicity supports all aspects of student life, including but not limited to career services and development, student conduct and well-being, student success and accessibility services, and you can learn more by visiting simplicity.com or connect with them on Facebook, X, and LinkedIn. To all of our listeners, if you're listening today and not subscribed to our weekly newsletter, please take a moment, go to our website, studentaffairsnow.com, and put your email in there. We send just one email a week about our latest episode on Wednesdays. And while you're there, you can visit our archives. Once again, I'm Heather Shea. Thanks to everybody who's watching and listening. Let's make it a great week.